So, I think this is an exciting venture. And I'm eager to see it right from the outset as a different kind of amicus brief. In one sense, a kind just exactly like they've seen before, that is the text document. Will be an amicus brief. But in another sense, it will carry links to blog space. And from there to a huge wealth of stuff. That's what I'm thinking. I want to be speaking from the viewpoint of founder of the Berkman Center. Fern's voice will come separately, or interspersed, or something like that. In pursuit of an overall goal of seeing cyberspace beautifully built. Some sense of ultimately asking help from the justices in considering this case in the form of not screwing things up. It's like the thesis I want to present to them is that litigation is not the way build cyberspace. And the Sony principle stands as a nice, clear principle that they worked hard to generate, that the space has so far been reflecting. And if they tinker with it now, they just reward the lawyers and create a field day of litigation to follow in the wake of working out what some new principle means in a contentious environment. So that's the basic thrust. Now the power of the argument I'd like to go for is to take the Sony principle at its word. Producer, manufacturer who produces a product that can be used for both infringing and non-infringing uses is and should be not liable when users infringe, as long as the product is capable of a substantial non-infringing use. That's how I'm understanding the principle.
Yeah, that's how I understand it too. Although, I mean, I've been doing some of this work reading these other amicus briefs, and some of them try to spin it other ways.
There's two ways that the opposition can go. They can either say we've got to change the principle.
Right.
Or they've got to say we're not changing the principle. We're applying the true principle, and it comes out here. Liability for the manufacturers.
Well, that's what the Solicitor General's brief claims to do.
That's the slippery slope.
Right.
That's the one you'd expect them to come with.
Right.
Right. That's the one that says to the Supreme Court, you're not really doing anything here.
Right.
No, don't.
This is exactly what you were trying to do in the first place. The Ninth Circuit just got it wrong.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. So I think the power in our brief comes in reifying for the justices the substantial non-infringing uses. reality of privacy, of piracy. And if you fix on piracy as the problem, then you can be led down the garden path. But if you see the problem as much more significantly one of engineering, of law, of actually building code, law in the sense of legislatively providing the environment in which such code can be well built and implemented, fairly built and fairly implemented. Then you see that as the priority. You see that a whole bunch of litigation is just a distraction, and it totally is. I attended this conference down in New York just last Friday, at which it was so evident that you could put the issue right on the table for people. And this was in a room that had content owners, consumer electronics, telecom, the ISPs, and a whole bunch of engineers. Clear that the engineers think the solution lies with them. And these guys were presented with the issue, and they were so taken up with their fixation on piracy that they couldn't even get the discussion to sound rational to me. Weird. Not weird, I guess it's understandable. Alright, so I think it's a pretty good line of argument. Now, we would like to speak in an unusual way also. We would like the brief to come from Fern and me. And to be on behalf of our children. And the generations of children that they represent. That's the idea. And explain how how freedom of expression in the net is important to their lives. And I actually want to be exercising freedom of expression in the net, in the way we write the brief.
That meaning?
Meaning, conceive of cyberspace as a rhetorical space that's made up of nodes, each connected to any other, or all others. All connections possible, each capable of sending and receiving message. So it's a messaging space.
Like a constellation.
Yes, right. If you espouse democracy in this space, then any node would be capable of receiving and sending. And ultimately, every person would have access to a node. And in that environment where you can listen to any node you want to, it's your choice. It's possible that any person's message can light up the space. Right? Now, just stop and pause on that for a moment. There are examples so far of things things that have happened in the net that have just lit up the space. Stunning examples, fascinating examples of things like huge amounts of money being raised for an ad in the New York Times by putting the idea up and suddenly in it comes. And so somehow to give muscle to this idea. All right, and the question then in that environment, is there, to bring it home to Grokster,
right,
is there a role for peer-to-peer? All right, peer-to-peer, what is it? It is an architecture for distributing content, which solves the problem of a single node, single source, being overburdened when the message catches. So you put up a message, if the world converges on your message and you haven't got peer-to-peer,
right,
you just get burned out. It's like a denial of service attack, except it's well intended. And peer-to-peer solves that problem.
It solves that problem because it allows all the other nodes to take that piece.
Take it. Right now, if I put my audio blog, when I put my audio blog up and you listen to it, you click on the blog.
Right.
And a box comes up and gives you a choice. Open or save to disk. If you stream it right from me, okay, that's a line to me.
That's not peer-to-peer.
Not peer-to-peer. If you save it to disk, and it would go into a peer-to-peer client, suddenly it's up there. All sorts of ways of getting it, all sorts of different ways of aggregating it. So yes, to understand that it solves a real problem in the world is vitally important. It's an engineering solution to a real-world digital environmental problem.
Well, then you'd think it gets rid of a rich-poor gap in terms of space and power.
You bet. This is democracy at work. Peer-to-peer. And once you've got that, then the principle that you want the engineering to be built clean, unencumbered, makes much more sense. If you're going to launch, this is a creative space, if you're going to allow it to be built, you want it to be built with elegant software.
Unencumbered by the kinds of things that Posner's talking about, the steps you have to take, unless they're too costly.
Something has to check something, and somebody has to go to a database and check something, and somebody has to do this, and they're each one impediments in the past, uncertainties. And if you ever put law behind a rule that threatens the businesses of making connections, then you know the businesses will cringe at the litigation costs. And come nowhere near the line. And that is chilling effect.
The risk is that we burn the whole thing out altogether by creating rules that will then create this level of breathing space around them that nobody will ever even want to risk it.
Definitely. If you're an internet service provider, or if you're the maker of a piece of software and you're vulnerable to a secondary liability for what your users can do with it, and you have rewarded the legal strategy by giving them this target so that the lawyers go back to the content clients and say, here, we brought you a victory. Now put more resources into us, and we will drive these companies away. A double tragedy. A limitation of the kind you're talking about that backs the companies away from a line, and a total distraction of resources
right.
and talent and focus from actually reaching constructive solution.
Right. The idea is that everybody who's got an idea now to build on the internet is going to have a lawyer who's going to advise them, you better not do this or you better not do that. And even if they still go forward with it, there's a huge resource trade-off in CYA that didn't exist before.
Yes, and as soon, this is a disruptive technology. We're talking about a disruptive technology. We all have to agree on that and see that. And it means that you diminish, you eliminate, perhaps, the strategy of an entrenched interest that is being disrupted to stop the disruption by imposing litigation costs on the startup companies that are making the generative products.
Right, and it preserves the internet for only those who can devote the resources to complying with the rules.
Yes.
Which means that the internet becomes, it's taken out of the hands of those wishing to disrupt and put into those with the interest of maintenance of the status quo.
Yes. And the status quo, not necessarily the internet, but of the world beyond the internet, the structures beyond the internet.
Right. So how's this going to look?
Well, I want it to look, I want it to be totally in the form of an amicus brief. So the amicus brief typically starts with identity of people from whom it comes, and a statement of interest, and then argument. And that's what I think it ought to have. I'd like to see the argument lead by demonstrating real understanding of the position of the disruptive industries. In a sense, what I'd like to do with this brief is talk past the lawyers to the clients in the content industry, and frankly convince them that litigation is not the way to go.
So when you say disruptive industries, what do you mean by that? What are the examples of?
The RIAA.
Okay.
I'm talking about the parties. The reason we're amicus here is that there are parties in contention and there are parties not there. Who is not represented in Grokster versus RIAA and MPA? Well, there's a lot of people not represented in that face-off. The disruptive industries, though, clearly in the context of this brief, are the music industry and the movie industry.
Right.
And they have a problem. In a sense, we're trying to convince them, we're maintaining to them, that although it looks like their number one problem is piracy, it's not. Their number one problem is generating the tools and the legal environment that will allow them to have enough control over their products in a digital environment to make markets for them. That's fair DRM.
So that's the alternative.
That is what they should be spending their time, attention, dollars, efforts at cooperative talk, legislative clout, you name it, that's the target.
And what does that look like? I'm not too hip to it yet.
Well?
So say I'm a movie producer and I produce the Charlie Nesson story and it goes out onto screens and it finds its way into a peer-to-peer system or into the internet. What's the system going to look like that's going to protect me and that product while still capturing all the benefits of what beautifully built cyberspace is going to look like?
Look at it from the point of view of a consumer. You have to offer me the movie in an attractive enough context so that I prefer getting it in that context to getting it through free services. All right, so first dispel the idea that you can't compete with free. iPod and iTunes is showing us that there are potential business models and no reason to think that they're anything but an early version of successful competition with free. Then, secondly, understand the context as being multifaceted. The first thing that comes to mind is the movie theater as opposed to the TV set or home screen. That's one form of context. And they clearly understand that that is an experience that people enjoy and will often prefer. Right?
Sure.
But beyond that, even in a TV context, there are other contextual elements. One is the comparison of how easy it is to get it on the free service. How easy for you, how starting from scratch, how many steps do you have to go through, and how clearly do you understand those steps that actually get you to an endpoint. A second component of that is the reliability of the process. How much chance do you take if you go the free route that it's going to misfire in some way and frustrate you? Third is a context potentially of citizenship. Idea that somehow by participating in one route, by following one route rather than another, you are affirming membership in some community. This competition between the lawful environments and the unlawful environments or free environments. From their point of view, that's the way it would be, unlawful environments. That's what they're competing against. Their competition is piracy. They need to see themselves as a character in the play. They're looking for allegiance of people. And so their attitude in addressing this very problem becomes a critical part of whether they have the affection of the consumer base. Hello? Yes. Yes, Pat, how are you?
I'm fine.
No, it's premature. I wrote Elena an email that was actually part of a thread. I had heard that she was going to see Miles. I wrote to her suggesting that she and I sit down together. She wrote me back. At that time, she hadn't herself heard that she was sitting down with Miles. She then wrote me back again as soon as she had heard and said, yes, we should talk. I wrote her back and said, I'm available anytime this week. I'll talk in person or by phone. I'm pretty much home in the mornings, and gave her my phone number. Have not heard back from her. How many people is she seeing while she's down there?
All right, so where were we?
We're talking about, if I can paraphrase it right, citizenship in a community based
right.
upon your actions. When you think that...
Right. I'm in a free space.
Right.
I can go to any point I want.
Right.
Some points are free, some points are not. What's going to make me want to go to the not space? That's a big. That's an open.
Right.
It's a psychological question. It's a, you're trying to affect my state of mind. Well, there's a character at that node. You turn around and think of it the other way. Here I am. I'm at this node. What is my character? What do I stand for? What is the deal I'm offering here?
It's either free or not free.
It can be free or not free. None of the free deals are totally free. They all carry. Time and association, and, a residue of knowledge that that's how you got the thing that you were getting for free. Who knows?
That every step along the way, there's a personal choice you're making.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And we want it to be as free a choice as it can be.
Given that if I'm a free agent and I'm choosing on the internet, how important in an ideal world should it be that I'm taking a risk of prosecution for direct infringement by me? Is that something that should go into my choice of which community I want to associate myself?
And this is an important point, because the counter-argument 2 hours will be that applying or changing the Sony principle is opening the door to allow them to go after a limited number of targets. And if that door remains closed to them, they have no choice but to go after zillions of users. So that, relatively speaking, they're talking about a few pieces of litigation on the one side and a deluge of litigation on the other. Well, that certainly will be their argument. And first, it's a funny kind of litigation that they're talking about. It's litigation of a rich, powerful corporation against an individual, where the cost of defending the litigation is itself such a penalty that you just knock people down. Second is a kind of litigation that courts will resist. I guess their point would be, well, help us out in resisting it by giving us another target. But it would surely be better from my point of view if the industry gave up the very notion of user infringement. Although that's worth thinking about. See, part of my thought on this is we're in the midst of a paradigm shift. So far, each new media that has been developed technologically creates a new communication space, radio and television. And each one carries with it apparent promise of distributed democratic media democracy. And so far each has failed and left a situation in which the adults, so to speak, control the world. But this one seems different. Everyone has the experience of the kids growing up in the environment being much more comfortable, much more adept, much more inventive in the space than the adults who come behind them. It's to the point where, you know, 3-year-olds are sitting at machines and learning how to play in the space. Well, to me, it's a travesty in terms of bringing up our youth to understand and create in this space, to be teaching them, as we do in kindergarten, to share. That's the first principle of social engagement. And then we qualify that with, but don't take Andrew's pencil or Andrew's doll. So we introduce some ideas of physical property.
Keep your hands to yourself.
Keep your hands to yourself. But share information. Oh boy, everything's back and forth. Totally open with information. And to introduce into that picture, backed by law, the idea that what these kids are doing, and let's be clear, they're doing it because it's fun, it's interesting, it's rewarding, it's like playing in the field, to introduce the idea that what those kids are doing is illegal, and that parents somehow trying to beat on the kids' heads with messages that no, there are copyrighted things that you can't do, you know, trying to teach your toddler copyright. It's so crazy in terms of the way a teacher would think about bringing up your students so that they just think straight and logically, and they get one fundamental concept after another until a point where they can get sophisticated. So I don't know where that leads, but maybe it leads to some agement. You know, at what point in a kid's career towards adulthood should they be expected to have mastered the concepts of intellectual property?
I don't know. I'm in copyright now and can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, that's the question that I think should be put to the industry. I'm not ready to answer.
Yeah.
But I think if they could see that that is a real question, then a table opens up at which we could talk.
And that ties back into what you were talking about before, about people making choices.
Yes.
About what they want to do. You could preserve the normative principle that it's wrong to take this movie without paying for it, even in a world where there's in reality no deterrent to doing that. I'm trying to think of some examples of other things where that's true, where there's a norm against something that works even without penalty behind it. It's littering. Well, that does have a penalty behind it, though the chance of being caught is so insignificant to reduce it to almost nothing.
Well, I think there's a whole world of norms that aren't backed by law in terms. We use law as a way of trying to affirm norms. And indeed, it's when our norms get out of whack with the law that you get the phenomenon of the law making our children criminals. I want to speak myself as a parent in the picture and say, don't facilitate it. Yeah.
Well, it's been a while now, but this is what Tocqueville was talking about, democracy, and that in reality, the norms created by society, and I would assume parenting would be among them, are more important in our lives than laws are. Of course, he was writing at a time when we had a heck of a lot less law than we do now. But it's the same kind of idea, that in a world where the law is not involved, we have a better chance of teaching children to do the right thing than in a world when law is involved. And that, of course, begins from the premise that it even is the wrong thing at all to take a Metallica song off the internet for free. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. That's probably a good argument to have in the outset, but even if you assume it's wrong, which certainly the plaintiffs in the case do, we might be able to solve better in the long term than changing the law now.
Yes, exactly. And putting legal limits